Made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. Throughout history, many cultures have used the labyrinth as a tool for meditation and healing. There are 16 public labyrinths in Illinois. They can be found in settings such as parks and medical centers. Champaign-Urbana now has a public labyrinth created by stone sculptor Marty Kermeen. It will be dedicated on May 21st, 2004 at Crystal Lake Park in Urbana. The dedication is set for 4:30 in the afternoon. On the program today, our topic is the labyrinth. Three guests join us for the discussion. Joining us by telephone is labyrinth maker Robert Ferret. He will be the keynote speaker at the dedication of the labyrinth at Crystal Lake Park. He will also present a workshop on sacred geometry at the Crystal Lake Labyrinth Conference on May 22nd. We'll have more information about the conference later in the program. With me in the studio here in Urbana, landscape architect Kaizad Irani and project coordinator for the Crystal Lake Labyrinth, Kathleen Brinkman. Kaizad Irani and his students at Parkland College in Champaign have designed and built the landscape at the labyrinth site at Crystal Lake Park. He was also a member of a team that won a competition last year to design an acre-sized park in New York City, honoring the victims of September 11th and the workers and the residents that kept that area alive following the attack. Kathy Brinkman is the coordinator for the Baker Board Project. The project has been the Baker Board's vision. It set the Labyrinth Project in motion, joining with members of the community as well as the Urbana Park District and Carle Foundation. The Baker Board is affiliated with Wesley United Methodist Foundation at the University of Illinois. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion. I invite your questions about labyrinths for our guests. Your comments also invited. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. To the three of you, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
To begin with, I think we need to answer a very basic and important question. Mm-hmm. What is a labyrinth? Maybe, Robert, you would take that question.
Okay. Well, generally, we begin by pointing out the difference between a labyrinth and a maze, because if you look up the word labyrinth on the Internet, you get a lot of games and puzzles, and you get the movie called Labyrinth with David Bowie and Jim Henson from about 20 years ago. And so people picture hedge mazes and Jack Nicholson running through the hedge maze with an axe or whatever. And that's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is a pattern that has a single path. There are no intersections, and there are no decisions to be made, and so your mind can relax when you're walking the labyrinth, because there's nothing to figure out. It's just exactly the opposite end of the scale from a maze in which your mind is fully engaged. So a labyrinth is generally seen as a way to relax and to meditate.
Okay. And so the purpose of the type of labyrinth we're talking about is not to become lost, not to entertain ourselves, but to purposefully move in and through a complicated path. Kathy, maybe you'd talk with us about the process of making the walk.
There's usually three stages to that. The first stage is where you're at the entrance, and some people will set an intention, how they would like to walk, or what if they have perhaps a question in mind. And then the next step is really literally to start following the path through all the twists and turns. And as you're doing that, you're so focused on the twists and turns and the walking that you tend to forget or let go of some of the chatter in your mind. The second phase is, or the stage, would be the center. You've reached the center. And there, because your mind has been cleared of some of that busy stuff that often occurs in our head, some people call it monkey mind, people then are able to tune into their inner self, their inner voice. And some people simply relax. And oftentimes, if they had a question or a problem that they were working on, sometimes the answer sort of bubbles up from their intuition or their inner voice. And then the last step, of course, is to go back out through the same path and to sort of integrate that. How am I going to apply this message or what I've learned from the center into my everyday life?
Hmm. Kai said, a question for you. The power of the labyrinth, is it its symbolism? Is it the shape which mirrors so much in nature? That's something I'm sure that you're very sensitive mm-hmm. to. Is it the act of making this purposeful walk, as Kathy mm-hmm. was talking about? Mm-hmm. Is it all of these things? Is it more?
It is exactly. It is actually a combination of all these things that you've mentioned. And the other thing that Robert, being truly an expert on, I'm sure can touch on, is the sacred geometry. As an architect and a landscape architect, that is something that I've been fascinated from my days as an architect growing up in India, surrounded by the spirituality that abounds out there and the geometry within the temples and the spaces. And as the experts know, India had its share of labyrinths. And I was truly honored to be a part of this project. And when I looked at the design, that was the core idea, is not to take away the sacred geometry of the labyrinth with the garden, but only to enhance it. And something that Kathy touched on with the walk is something that we constantly, if there's a problem, a lot of times we seek answers outside, but truly the answers lay within. And it's like what I always say, the way is within. And that's what even the garden echoes. You actually come to the center if you walk the garden before you walk or as you enter the labyrinth. And that sort of gets you ready. The idea is to get you ready for this journey. And again, a lot of times it's always the journey that makes the sense as opposed to the destination. I mean, you get to the center, seek your answers, and then the way out is truly first from the way in. And then you walk yourself out of the labyrinth.
Yeah, Robert?
Yes, well, I did want to make one comment about something that you said earlier about how we use the labyrinth. And the labyrinth can be a form of entertainment. We don't want people to think that the labyrinth is something that has to always be serious and they have to come with the intentions of deep meditation and personal, self-examination or something. The idea that you can walk a labyrinth joyfully is very important, that children run the labyrinth, that you can dance on the labyrinth, have a good time on the labyrinth. So we just want to make sure that we all remember that the labyrinth is many things, and meditation and introspection just happen to be a couple of those.
Yeah, one of the articles I read about labyrinths suggested they were the original hopscotch.
Yes, well, hopscotch and children's games in medieval times were used to encode esoteric information that wasn't supposed to be available publicly, and hopscotch was one of those. If you look at the shape of hopscotch, it's often a straight body with two arms and a rounded top, and that's the shape of a Gothic cathedral also. And the labyrinth originated in Gothic cathedrals, and all of these things really do tie in together in many ways.
And would you like to say... Pardon me, I turned my microphone off. Would you like to say something about... Kaiser had mentioned sacred geometry.
Right.
What is sacred geometry?
The term sacred geometry probably sounds like an oxymoron to most people, because how could anything as seemingly cold and impersonal as mathematics be sacred or have anything to do with sacred things? But that's because in our modern era, science and mathematics have been taken over by computers and mechanical things, which really do take away a lot of the ancient meanings. But science, as we know it, is only a few hundred years old, and sacred geometry is thousands of years old. It's based on the principle that there was a divine creator that created the physical universe, and in order for the divine creator to actually manifest things in time and space in three dimensions, there had to be certain rules, certain principles that were followed. And so by investigating nature and studying nature, we can come to understand what these rules are, and then we use those same rules to use in our own creations, so that virtually all temples and churches or Gothic cathedrals, but also artwork and architecture and many other things, use these proportions found in nature. And so it's sacred geometry for a very simple reason, and that is that it originated in the divine mind that created the universe.
Mm. I'd like to share a statement by a man by the name of Keith Critchlow. Now, I don't know who he is, but I found this comment of his in the book Walking a Sacred Path, Rediscovering right. the Labyrinth as a Spiritual Tool right. by Dr. Lauren R. Tress. And here's the quote. "The labyrinth is a model of spiritual cosmology that is quite unrecognizable to the modern mentality, since this understanding disappeared after the acceptance of Descartes' world view and the split of the mind, body, spirit."
Right. Well, I've studied with Keith Critchlow, and I know him quite well, and it's one of his purposes to bring back into modern awareness some of the ancient principles, so that labyrinths, for example, really very much resemble the medieval image of the universe of being concentric spheres, where each the orbits of each succeeding planet is spherical, and so it's like the little Russian dolls inside of each other, except these are spheres inside of each other. And so the labyrinth is sort of a crosscut of that, where you see the concentric circles, and it's really meant to be an image of the whole cosmos, but it can also be an image of atoms or very minute things. So it's across the entire spectrum.
Okay, so again, back to this idea of mirror of the universe, mirror of nature. And when I was thinking about this earlier today, I was thinking of the web, I mean a spider's web, mm-hmm. the shape of the ear, mm-hmm. a child in utero,
mm-hmm.
Shells, the nautilus.
Right.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
And sure. that's exactly, in fact, if you look at the, that was the true inspiration also for the gardens, if you will look at it. I mean, they are spheres within, almost like an onion peeling away the layers. And again, it starts out in the center with these multi-layers or multi-spheres, if you will, very much concentric, but then again divided into four quadrants. And then also keeping up with a sensory approach. I mean, when you walk through the gardens to get to the labyrinth, or if you approach the labyrinth and then walk back out through the gardens, you know, your mind, body, spirit will be stimulated. I mean, in terms of fragrance, color, movement, a lot of grasses, a lot of herbs. I mean, again, picking up on some of the Gothic and medieval, I mean, healing herbs, lavender, I mean, catmint, you know, just fragrances, foliage, colors. And again, a four-season approach. It's not that one of these gardens that only looks good in spring and summer, but it has to be a four-season where some of the evergreens and the textures, the forms, the massing, I mean, sort of the main basic principles of landscape design all truly come to life in this garden.
Hmm. And Kathy, maybe you would talk, but we haven't talked about the labyrinth at Crystal Lake Park. Would you like to describe it for us? And what does it look like?
Okay.
How big is it?
First of all, I like to describe it as an interactive two-dimensional sculpture, because the artist Marty Kermin actually carved the concrete pavers and fitted those in. So it's flat, and as Robert pointed out earlier, it's not, some people still think it's a hedge or bushes that are creating the labyrinth, and it is not. So this is done with bricks that have been carved. The colors are buff and charcoal, so we went for high contrast so that people could see it easily. It's 42 feet in diameter, and it is an exact replica of the Chartres Cathedral-style labyrinth. It is surrounded by its own garden, and then there's a narrow path, as Kaizad was explaining, to another garden area where we have inscribed bricks for people who had donated money to the labyrinth. We will have a finger labyrinth there for people who are unable to walk the labyrinth, so they still may participate by using the finger labyrinth, and we will also have a dedication plaque there as well. We have two benches that will currently be installed, and we are looking, of course, for more donors for benches. We would like to add probably at least four more benches.
At least four more, that's correct.
So we would love to have those. And those benches are special because they have a spiral carved into them, so they're beautiful. So that's pretty much what the labyrinth looks like. And there is, if you face the entrance looking north, there's a kind of, through vegetation, a kind of window that they have created that's very nice as
It sounds wonderful. I wish we could show pictures.
Absolutely. Also, if I might add to that, it is very accessible by everybody. I mean, that was one of the key components of the design when I met with members of the Baker Board and the Park District, going through what the physical requirements of the garden would be. That was one thing that was stressed from day one. We do want to make sure that everybody can access it. It is up, meets ADA standards. You can easily walk up or wheel a chair up to it and walk the path and exit it. So we have absolutely been cognizant of those facts.
Okay, very good. We have a listener waiting to talk with us. Let's go and talk with our caller. First one this afternoon, line one in Urbana. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted Kathy or Robert or one of them to address the way that walking a labyrinth sort of integrates the mind and the body, because my experience in walking the labyrinth has been that there's something about the movement of walking that curved path that settles the mind, but it sort of integrates it with the motion. It's sort of hard to put into words, but I think it's an important component when you were talking about the mind-body-spirit split of the post-Descartes era. I thought the labyrinth is a way that sort of integrates those aspects.
It's about connection.
Mm-hmm. I think that you can consider it in some ways a walking meditation. For those of you who've tried to meditate and you're just sitting and trying to focus, I find that involving your entire body in the motions, as you mentioned, walking and doing those turns, you're focused on the turns, you're focused on the walking, the winding of the path, that takes, it's a complete effort. Your mind is focused, your eyes are focused, your feet are focused on walking these twists and turns in the path. And I think that's part of what the integration experience is. As you're walking this path to the center, you know that there will be no wrong turns. You know that you will get to the center. So there's not the problem-solving aspect, but there is the focus on your coordination of your body and your eyes and your mind on this path. And I think that's the part of integration that you might be referring to.
When you talk about the Cartesian split between body, mind, and soul, the next part of that is that mind and soul were pretty much disregarded in the scientific and materialistic age, and only the body, only physical things that you can see was given much attention. And so our daily lives are very much about appearances, about actions, about rushing around and going places. And so one of the things that the labyrinth does is it just gives us time out to be with ourselves. And that turns out to be a very moving thing to do in a society where everyone is rushing around so hectically, to just take some time out. It's not, you know, we're not checking things off our list of things to do for the day. We're not fixing dinner or running errands. We're just walking the labyrinth with ourselves, softly, contemplatively. And it turns out that that's a very moving thing to do. And I really do believe, as Kathy said, that it helps put the pieces back together from our sort of feeling that we're splintered all over the place.
Kaizad, do you want to add anything?
I totally agree with that. I mean, that is, in fact, one of the things we're talking about earlier. I personally have actually experienced that. I mean, I was familiar a little bit with the philosophy and the concept behind walking the labyrinth, but also having personally practiced Tai Chi. I mean, this is almost, I mean, where it gives you almost the same benefits as you would if you were practicing some sort of an internal martial art. And there have been times, we're talking about this earlier with Kathy and Dee, that if I was stuck while I was working on the design, you run into what I would call a landscape architect's block, similar to writer's block. What do I do with this corner? There were times I would be out there early in the morning in the peace of the pre-dawn hours and just literally walk that. And just to see what, you know, what is this feeling that people are talking about? And truly, I can say I've experienced that. I mean, it is a phenomenal experience. It's one of these that you have to personally do it to experience it. We can talk about it all we want, but when somebody gets there and walks it, I mean, that is there. I mean, proof is out there.
And the experience is very personal.
Yes.
It will vary a lot from one person to another. So if you see one person walking the labyrinth and something particular happens to them, it doesn't necessarily mean that when you walk the labyrinth that the same experience will happen to you. I really think the labyrinth embraces each of us exactly where we are and addresses us individually, so that most people say there's no particular way you're supposed to walk a labyrinth and there's no particular experience that you're supposed to have when you do it.
Is the caller still there?
I'm still there. Yes, thank you very much. And I just wanted to say, yes, labyrinth is also for fun. The last time I was out there, there was a little, maybe 4-year-old boy that was having a great time sort of skipping through the path. So it's for all ages. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Labyrinths, our topic this afternoon here on the program. We have three guests with us today. Joining us by telephone is labyrinth maker Robert Ferret. He will be the keynote speaker at the dedication of the labyrinth at Crystal Lake Park, which is set for Friday, May 21st from 4:30 to 5:30 in the afternoon. And the labyrinth is located in Crystal Lake in the West Woods along Orchard Street in Urbana. Here with me in the studio, we have two guests, landscape architect Kaizad Irani and project coordinator for the Crystal Lake Labyrinth, Kathleen Brinkman. Also coming up on Saturday, the 22nd of May, there is a Labyrinth Project Conference. And the Crystal Lake Labyrinth Conference will take place on Saturday, the 22nd. For details and registration, you can call 217-344-1120. 344-1120. And the conference will take place at the Anita Purvis Center, which is on Broadway in Urbana at the park. And it begins at 9 a.m. Kathy, do you want to say anything more about the conference?
Sure. The conference will begin at 9 o'clock, and there will be four different workshops presented. And those workshops will be, Robert Ferret will have Sacred Geometry. Virginia Lone Sky will be presenting Creating a Community Through the Labyrinth. In the afternoon, we'll have John Ritter doing a workshop on Creating a Labyrinth, How to Build One, the Nuts and Bolts of Building a Labyrinth. And Debbie Kermeen will be presenting a workshop on drumming, Sacred Drumming for Joy. And later, artist Marty Kermeen will share with us stories from his visit to the Shark Cathedral, and it's entitled Stories from Along the Labyrinth Path.
And he's the stone sculptor.
Yes.
That built the labyrinth in Urbana. Listeners, you can join the conversation here this afternoon with your questions and comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. You know, one of the interesting things I think is here is that we mentioned that there has been sort of a mind-body-spirit disconnect in modernity, but at the same time, labyrinths are now being built mm-hmm. in medical centers. Mm. So,
all over, actually.
Who in the field is interested in labyrinths, and is the process of walking a labyrinth being studied in terms of what its benefits are?
Mm-hmm. To my knowledge, I don't think that they've conclusively proven how labyrinths work, but who knows, maybe that study is forthcoming. But yes, they are in several kinds of hospitals, the Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore, Maryland. There's one in, now of course there'll be one by Carle Foundation, but there is one in St. Joseph, Illinois, in Elgin, Illinois, and another famous one is California Pacific Medical Center in California. But they're also in parks. They're in schools. For example, Ohio State University has one in their arboretum, and Northern Illinois University in DeKalb has one. So they're all over. There's one in Plano, Illinois, in an elementary school, and the kids walk them there. Yeah.
So I think that the connection with hospitals is gaining a lot of momentum and is growing. On our website, which is labyrinthenterprises.com, we have a list of more than 80 hospitals. I think it's up to 84 now, hospitals around the United States that have labyrinths at this time. And when you talk to architects that specialize in hospital design, they're all talking about holistic approaches now. They're all talking about how can we design the facility and the building and the view and the lighting and the decor and everything to be as healing as possible. So it's a great departure from the earlier idea that medicine was just scientific and you go to a hospital and they give you a pill and you get better. They're beginning to realize the non-physical component of healing, and that healing is as spiritual as it is physical, probably more so. And so the labyrinth, I make the comparison that modern science heals the body and the labyrinth heals the soul, and together the whole person receives the healing.
Mm. You know, Kai, I was in the hospital several years ago, and I didn't know how long I was going to be in there, and somebody came to me and very kindly said, "Is there anything you'd like, or can we do anything?" And I said, "Could we go outside?"
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I think that is just, you know, it was so important to me, and something I think I probably took for granted. But I wanted fresh air, and I wanted mm-hmm. to be away from the beeps mm-hmm. and the buzzes and all the noise.
Mm-hmm. Right. But some of the there are hospital labyrinths that are indoors.
Right.
That are the portable labyrinths, because some patients can't
sure.
get out into the open air. But healing gardens are another aspect that, with or without labyrinths, that are being appreciated more and more in hospital settings.
Yeah, I guess my comment is that wouldn't it be nice if hospitals had gardens?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Right.
In fact, Robert just touched on that, the term healing garden. There's a whole field within the world of horticulture and landscape design called horticultural healing, where they're actually offering now, I know University in Kansas is offering actually a four-year degree where people can actually specialize in horticultural healing. One of my colleagues, when I was going through my master's program at the University of Illinois, now in Wisconsin and the Chicago area, dealing with horticultural healing, the Chicago Botanic Garden, nature has always been a great healing force, whether in terms of the food that nature provides in terms of herbs and the plants, but also the entire, almost the field of complementary medicine, if you will. Look at all the spas and all the healing centers that people go to, whether it's California, East Coast, West Coast, even in the Midwest, they're always associated with nature, water, walks. I mean, if you will, a walk through nature, no different than a walk through the labyrinth, where, again, it's a defined path. You don't have to think, do I turn here? Do I go here? But you're within yourself, enjoying and reaping the rewards of nature. And that whole mind-body, aspect with nature. I mean, not only just the fact of being out there in the outdoors with this great, breathing in the fresh air, but the fragrance of the plants, the sight, the sound, the soothing greens, the blues. I mean, everything is just all-encompassing and just a phenomenal experience.
Let's talk with another listener, a caller in Urbana, Line 1. Go ahead.
I was just wondering if you could talk about the cost of the things that you still need donations for, or how someone would contact you to find out those things?
I would suggest that you contact Tim Bartlett of the Urbana Park District. I can tell you, for example, one of those beautiful, beautiful benches, the carved spiral benches, are $500. Plantings and trees will have varied costs, price tags with them, but Tim Bartlett of the Urbana Park District would be the person that you'd want to contact and ask about that.
Okay. Thanks a whole bunch.
Thanks for the call. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, how did the Baker Board get interested in this project, and where did you begin?
The Baker Board traditionally brings inspirational speakers, or we will host experiential workshops. And in the fall of 2000, we had a series of experiential workshops based on meditation. And so we brought in a portable labyrinth. People from Springfield, the Klinkenborgs, brought that in and hosted a workshop for us. We had such interest. We had so many people sign up for this workshop that we had to do two. We did one in the morning and one in the afternoon. Later that year, the Baker Board received an invitation from the Indiana Labyrinth Coalition to attend a workshop, which a couple of us did. And there we learned about other people who were building labyrinths. And from there, we decided that this would be something that we would like to have in our community. So we approached Urbana Park District and partnered with them and started in the spring of 2001 our labyrinth project, that's what we dubbed it, and proceeded to do outreach and fundraising in the subsequent years. I can tell you that it was highlighted by some really very interesting things that we did. One was in 2002, we co-sponsored a 9/11 Labyrinth Walk for Peace. And we had three different labyrinths in different areas in Champaign-Urbana. And we invited people on 9/11 to come and meditate on peace. And we had a pretty good turnout for that. I think it was a place for people to go. Mm. We then, in the following spring, this was in 2003, we participated in the Boneyard Arts Festival. Cynthia Pipkin Doyle, who is a dance instructor at the University of Illinois, she choreographed three original dances that were performed at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts on April, I think it was 18th and 19th. And we had a very good turnout for that, and the dances were a lot of fun. So going back to the idea that the labyrinth can be used in a number of different ways, the dance was certainly evidence of that. And then in May of that year, 2003, we were fortunate enough to have Verde Gallery sponsor for a month a fundraiser for us. And Kurt Tucker invited artists from across the nation to donate artwork that is labyrinth-based or labyrinth-inspired, and we had an exhibit, and it was wonderful. There were some interesting pieces. And then he split the proceeds with us, so it was a fundraiser for us. And those were some of the things. It was very interesting to see how people incorporated the labyrinth in all different type of medium. We had glass, we had ceramics, we had oil and paint, you know, all sorts of things. It was beautiful. Hmm.
Kaizad, how did you come to be involved in this project?
Actually, Tim Bartlett, a friend and colleague of mine back from the University of Illinois days, he approached us with regards to Parkland, working with them on several projects, on Parkland students. And Parkland, its true strength also lies in working within the community, as you know. And I gladly jumped on it and talked to him. And it started out as a student project. I mean, I do student projects, design projects, where students divide up into groups and actually work on a common project, and I figured this would be one great project for them to get some outside experience, so to speak, and what we call a real live project as opposed to a make-believe project that sometimes go on in the world of design. But at Parkland, we do hands-on real life projects, and this was great. So it started out with that, and then it's the same class that actually then put together the construction. So I was able to, I would say, fortunately coordinate this. And then what I did for the final design is it got some inspiration from the student projects and then came up with this actual design that you see out there right now. And then the students, within a span of about 8 weeks, meeting only twice a week, I do want to mention this, because without their efforts, the actual construction part, I'm sure Kathy and other members would agree, would not have been possible, because they truly dedicated themselves to this, and they've learned so much from this, where they get to see a project that comes from design, a two-dimensional piece of paper, come to life in the third dimension and experience it. and to work on a project as, I would say, unique and phenomenal as the Labyrinth, it's a chance of a lifetime. I mean, to the students, this is what we at Parkland call a living portfolio. It's great to see they brought their family members out there, their spouses, their girlfriends. I mean, even kids. I've taken my boys out there. And it's just been a great, rewarding experience in more than one way.
Mm. Robert Ferret, what sparked your interest in labyrinths, and when did you begin dedicating your life to this?
Well, my interest in labyrinths stemmed from my interest in Gothic cathedrals. I lived in France for a couple of years, and I've been to Chartres Cathedral 48 times over 35 years. Mm. And so I had seen the labyrinth, but it wasn't really until Lauren Artris at Grace Cathedral in California began actually doing meditative seminars with the labyrinth that it caught my attention. And so since it was associated with Chartres Cathedral, I decided to look into it. And then my story is much like many other people, that the labyrinth sort of grabbed them. Mm-hmm. It just sort of caught their attention and wouldn't let go. And so I studied the geometry of the labyrinth and learned how to draw it, and then soon found that while there was a popular resurgence of interest in walking the labyrinth, not very many people knew how to actually build them. And so one thing led to another, and I ended up in 1995 beginning to build labyrinths, and I have done so now for the last 9 years.
Mm. So there's really been a blossoming of interest then in labyrinths over the last decade?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, starting probably in the late 1980s. There's been a resurgence in two different areas. In the church area, which was fostered by Grace Cathedral and Lauren Artris, but also in the sort of secular generic use of labyrinths, which was a little earlier, actually, beginning in the mid to late 1980s, and that was in the dowsing community. You think of dowsers as the people who look for water with pointed sticks and things, but dowsing is a lot more than that, and they began to have labyrinths at their annual conferences, people began to put them in their backyards and so forth. And so the dowsers tended to lean toward the more ancient classical seven-circuit design, and the church folks tended to lead a little more towards the Chartres Cathedral one. But I think it's necessary to point out that although this pattern originated in Chartres Cathedral, When Chartres was built, it was like an encyclopedia of the world and all it contained. It was meant to represent all of creation, and so there and all of history. So, in the cathedral, there are statues of Pythagoras and Aristotle and Donatus, and in the center of the labyrinth, there was once a plaque that portrayed a Greek myth of Theseus and the Minotaur, and so forth. And so the labyrinth itself had a far greater meaning than just a narrow religious meaning. And so it shouldn't be construed today at all to be a very specifically religious symbol.
Yeah, it's been used by religious believers and non-believers throughout history.
Yes, absolutely.
How old is the labyrinth? Do we have some sense of that?
Well, the classic labyrinth is said to be over 4,000 years old, and they have evidence of labyrinths, the classic style labyrinth, on old coins that they've dated. The Chartres Cathedral labyrinth, I think, and Robert could correct me on the exact date, but is about the 12th century.
Yeah, it was built in 1201, probably, and that would make it just a little over 800 years old. In fact, we had an 800th birthday party for the labyrinth in 2001 in Chartres.
That's a lot of candles.
Yeah, that's right.
Why the contemporary interest in labyrinths, do you suppose? Is it something maybe we're just at a time and place we need it? We need it?
I would say, I mean, again, like I mentioned earlier, the healing aspect. I mean, why are people in my field as far as landscape architecture goes. There are people who are spending literally a lot more, twice to three times as much money in creating gardens that they can actually stay at home and relax and actually have their own private paradise in the backyard. And why has all this come about? I would say it's probably the change in lifestyles that we're experiencing. Mm-hmm. You know, the sheer pressures from work, what we do, I mean, family, the whole nine yards, the world. I mean, look at the changing world around us with everything going on. So we try to create our own little, you know, our own little respite gardens, if you will. And the labyrinth, I believe, is an ideal place for a man or woman or people to go to and actually seek this. I mean, we're all looking for answers. Why this? I mean, why is this happening? What's going to happen? You know, where do I go from here? And, you know, the symbology within the labyrinth, or the peacefulness within labyrinths or gardens for that matter, that is something that is drawing us as human beings in the current world that we live in, and just seeking the answers.
I quite agree. I think there's, for me, there's something very, that really draws me to that, to the design. That spiral is so basic that it's such an archetypal symbol to me that draws me to it. And I also agree and echo with what Kaisa had said. There's something about this change in our technology. We're going from the, you know, from a manufacturing economy to this biotechnology and nanotechnology, and things are moving so quickly. There's so much chaos in our lives that I think this offers a respite. This offers a way to kind of deal with our stress. It gives us that quiet space to be with ourselves. And I think that's what draws people. It draws me to it for that reason. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Robert, you want to chime in?
Yeah, I think you said it when you asked the question. I think we need it. I think it's here because it speaks to people. There are some scholars who believe that the labyrinth has reappeared throughout history at times of spiritual and moral crisis. And I think as we look at the distressed world around us, that there might be a good argument that that's why it's come back at this time. Mm.
The stress and distress of the world really does impinge upon us. We live in a 24/7 world. Mm-hmm. Here's what I want to ask. So when we go to Crystal Lake Park now, how do we prepare for entering this space, slowing it down? You know, how much time do we need to allow? Should we, before we leave the house, should we prepare ourselves for what we're about to experience?
You know, I think Robert had mentioned this earlier, and it's really so individual how you come and approach the labyrinth. I've walked the labyrinth when I've been in a wonderful mood, and it's been a very joyous walk for me. I've come to it in a terrible mood and come out calmer as a result of that. I don't think necessarily you need to start preparing to walk the labyrinth. I think that Kaizad has done such a marvelous job of designing the surrounding area that when you come to it and enter the first garden, that will start to set you in the mood. And then as you come to approach the entrance, you know, in whatever state you are in, that's the state that you will walk the labyrinth. And that experience for you will be very individual. And as Robert pointed out, you know, there is really no particular way to walk it.
You might want to skip it.
Right
or
wrong.
You know, hop.
Exactly.
Hop.
And some people, you know, some people will sit and just watch other people walk. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's also very soothing.
Yes.
So, you know, it can be used in many, many different ways.
In fact, if I could totally, the aspect of watching others, to me, when I first time, before I actually did anything, we had a portable labyrinth that was brought out to Parkland College, and the students actually walked it. And sitting on the outside, to me, that itself was so soothing. I mean, we had a nice classical piece of music playing, and it just heightened the mood. And in fact, that stayed with me so deeply that I've created sitting pods, if you will. I mean, sitting areas around the garden where you can sit and watch people. And that itself is a meditative experience. Mm-hmm. And then one more thing, if I can add to, appreciate Kathy's comment on the design aspect. I've also studied aspects of the Japanese tea gardens. And we're fortunate to have a real nice one here at the Japan House. And one of the main experiences is going in with an open mind. I mean, a lot of times if you expect something, you might not get what you want. Mm-hmm. So go in with a very, almost a beginner's mind or a Zen mind, if you will, and And in all the tea ceremonies or tea gardens, there is what's known as a preparation area where you actually cleanse yourself ritually, spiritually, before you experience the tea gardens. And that was one of the key concepts within creating this garden, that it should be sort of the only preparation you need is when you get in there. Literally, the environment and the ambiance will naturally calm you down or get you in that mood with the fragrances, the colors, things I was talking about earlier. And then you walk. Then there's just a straight. It's a unicursal path. You walk straight up to the labyrinth and start your walk within and experience. And then who knows what you might discover. Mm-hmm. It is phenomenal.
So the only thing I need to do is throw the to-do list away.
That's right. Just yes, don't.
Yes. Okay. Oh, no.
Oh, no. All is lost.
Just go on the air whenever you feel like it.
Very good. Well, we've run out of time, I'm sorry to say. I want to thank the three of you very much for joining us. Kathy, one last word?
Just one last comment. I invite you all to a candlelight labyrinth walk, which will be at sunset on May 21st, and that will be about 8 o'clock that evening. That will be after the dedication ceremony, and it will be beautiful.
Okay, the dedication is set at Crystal Lake Park, the west woods of the park along Orchard Street in Urbana. You can park at the Champaign County Fairgrounds, right, off Orchard and Fairview Streets. And one of our guests will be the keynote speaker at the dedication, Robert Ferre. Robert, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
And also coming up on Saturday, the Crystal Lake Labyrinth Conference will take place at the Anita Purvis Center on Broadway in the park. That is Saturday, May 22nd. For details and registration, here's the number to call, 217-344-1120, 344-1120. Kathy Kaizad, thank you very much.
Thank you,
Celeste.
8 minutes before 2 o'clock, let's find out what happened today on the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks very much, Celeste. From Chicago, the Board of Trade, the Mercantile Exchange settlement prices are in. Let's start with the board this afternoon. Futures in the bean pit finished the day mostly higher, with just the January contract unchanged on the day. The corn futures were a bit higher after bouncing off the lows from yesterday. And the wheat pit finished the day lower. That on some rainfall that fell across parts of the Western Plains and helping out the wheat that's been parched for some time there. May wheat futures today, a high of 380, a low of 370, and settled on that low, down 8.5 cents. July futures at 386 on the high side, low at 378.25. Settlement price at 379. They finished down 6.25. And September futures, 392.5. The high, the low at 385. Settlement price there, 385.5, down 6.25. December contract in the wheat pit, 401.5. The high, the low at 395.25. Settlement price at 396. They finished down 5.25 on the day. March futures, 406.5 high, low at 401, settled 402, down 5.75. From the corn pit, the high today in the nearby May contract, 297.5, a low at 294.5, settled 296. They were up 0.5 cent. July futures, 299.5, the high, the low 296.5, a settlement price at 299.25. Up 3/4 in September, 296, the high, the low at 293.25, settlement price at 295.25, up 0.5 cent. And the December futures, 294 the high, the low at 289.5, a settlement price at 293.5, up 1.5. March contract now, 298.75 the high, the low at 294.75, settled 298.5, up 1.5. And May corn futures, 302 the high, low at 299, managed to stay above the $3 level for the May contract of 05 at 301.5 on a settlement price, up 1.75. July futures for 2005, 301.5 the high, the low at 298.5, settled $3.75 up 1.75. And the December contract, the only loser there for the day, 275 the high, the low at 273, settled at 273, down on that low for the December 2005 corn contract, a penny and a quarter lower. May oats now, 163, the high, the low at 162, settled on that low, unchanged. And the July had a high today of 168, a low at 165.5, a settlement price there at 167. They finished one higher. From the soy complex now, May soybeans, $10.55 the high, the low at 10.40, settled 10.53.5, up 13. July, 10.25 the high, the low at 10.12, settled 10.22.25, up 9.75. August soybeans, 9.54.5 the high, low at 9.43.5, settled 9.51.5, up 6.75. And the September contract, it was just 0.25 cent higher today, had a high of 8.21, a low at 8.14, settlement price there, up 0.25 cent at 8.18.75. November futures, 7.57 the high, low at 7.46, settled 7.54.75, up 2.25. And the January beans, 7.57 the high, the low at 7.50, settled 7.55, unchanged on today. Now the March contract, 7.49.5 the high, the low at 46.5, settled on that low at 7.46.5. Up 0.5 cent in the March 2005 soybean contract. May bean meal, 333.60 the high, the low at 328, settled 333.30, up 4.40. July bean meal, 329 the high, the low at 323.40, settled 328, they were up 370 for the day. May bean oil futures now, 331 the high, rather 33.10 the high, the low at 32.80, settled 33.10, they were up 12. And July futures, 32.62 the high, the low at 32.33, settled 32.48, they finished the day 10 higher. That's a look at what happened to the Chicago Board of Trade. Now here with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange is Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, Todd. May feeder cattle today's high 103.90, the low 103.25, the settlement 103.40, that down 12.5 cents. August feeder cattle today's high 145, the low that's $100.45, the low 99.75, the settlement $100.10, unchanged today. September feeder cattle 99 even the high 98.50, the low 98.80, the settlement that unchanged. June live cattle, 85.15, the high 83.77.5, the low 83.85, the settlement, that down 77.5 cents. July live cattle, 86.60, the high 86.50, the low 86.50, the settlement, that down 80 cents. August live cattle, 86.85. The high today for August live cattle, 85.52.5 the low. The settlement, 85.82.5, that down 87.5. May lean hogs, 81.37.5, the high, the low, 80.10. The settlement, 81.37.5, that up $2. June lean hogs, 76.50, the high, 75.25, the low. The settlement, 76.50, that up $2. Lean hogs for July, 77.25 the high, 75.65 the low, 77.05 the settlement, that up 1.17.5. August lean hogs, 74.50 the high, 72.80 the low, 74.37.5 the settlement, that up 1.37.5. May bellies, 123.25 the high, the low 122 even, the settlement 122.97.5, that up 37.5 cents. The Dow currently up 15 points at 10,005. The NASDAQ 31 higher at 1927. And the S&P 500 is up 6 points at 1093.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Illinois Farm Bureau, whose mission is to improve the economic well-being of agriculture and enrich the quality of farm family life.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Harry M. Fetterman, Jr. from Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania writes, Dear Dr. Science, what would happen if I were to send a slinky down and up escalator?
Well, it would create a perpetual motion paradox, causing great damage to the space-time continuum.